This is Tom V. I'd like to welcome him. His fourth week here.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Tom.
And, Hi, Tom.
Thank you for that. That's making me think that I'm something special, so I have to get humble now. I'm truly grateful to be here and to be able to share with you my experience, strength, and hope. And one of the things that I want to do is to be able to share with you is my experience. I don't want to give you my opinion or talk about something that I have not done. I want to focus, and I try to do that as much as possible as to giving you what I've done and how this book is come alive in my life. So the first couple of weeks, you know, we crammed a lot in, and we got to understand, just to recap as to where we are, because I really want to dig into We Agnostics this week if we can, and that, because that's putting me right into step two. So, you know, we went through the doctor's opinion, the allergy, and there was this little infusion of the spirituality, and Bill's story, which was chock full of the problem and then his solution. Did I drink the way that Bill drank? Did I think the way that Bill thought? And was I willing to go to the same lengths that Bill went to recover? The steps are all outlined in there. And then we finished up more. We didn't really finish reading it, but we really got to the insanity points in more about alcoholism. And it's really that thought. Just before I take that first drink, which Bill described on page 5, and I just want to hit it one more time. Bill talked about, shortly after I came home drunk, there had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? So I go back to that just simply because I need to be reminded of that thought just before I make that decision to take the action that makes me believe that I can drink safely. So I come into the program and I'm hit with this spiritual thing. I realize the fellowship is not enough because I tried that and it wasn't enough to keep me sober. I have to now get into the spiritual thing, and I'm rejecting God at this point. So my early recovery is I'm angry. I'm blaming God for everything. So I have to, in my mind, I have to get this warm, fuzzy relationship with God because it's all in the book. And really deep down inside, I feel comfortable with it because I've had that whole education, and I had that experience as a child growing up with my family and being connected. So I really wanted it, but I had this contempt prior to investigation. I wouldn't let it down. The prejudices, really, which are my old ideas. So we come into We Agnostics, and We Agnostics for me is getting me to where I can change my ideas, my emotions, and my attitudes. That's really where it is, and I've got to have this willingness. And this is where what the book is asking me to do. It's not demanding, it's really just putting it out there, and it's giving me a lot of good information and examples for me to consider and open myself up to just think about this. So on the chapter 4, We Agnostics, and first of all, so I'll do what my sponsor did to me. He said, you know, who's an agnostic in the room? And I was intimidated to raise my hand because I didn't know what an agnostic is. So I don't want to give you my opinion. I'm going to pull out my little big book dictionary, and I'm going to give you the definition as it's read in here. So it says agnostic, one who believes the existence or non-existence of God cannot be proven or known. A person unsure that God or a God exists. So I'm told that you're either an agnostic or an atheist. So what's an atheist? One who does not believe in the existence of God at all. So I am agnostic, and I'll tell you why I'm agnostic, just simply because I don't have the knowledge. I don't really know a lot about God. And that was my understanding. So my sponsor grabbed me like I was a piece of candy, and he started giving me all kinds of literature and information, and we would talk, and he would say to me, you know, Tom, where did you get your conception of God, which I had chosen at this point, where I had chosen God as my higher power. And he said, where are you getting this knowledge? So I was getting it from my childhood days, because I had done nothing. Once I was old enough to run from Sunday Mass, and I was able to run from organized religion, and I had a couple bucks in my pocket, I took off as a kid, and I realized I'm not coming back because I have freedom. But I stayed close to God. But I used him as an errand boy. Joe and Charlie talk about that. So as I said last week, I'm a disciple of Joe and Charlie. Carl B. is my sponsor, and in order to be in his will, I have to be a Joe and Charlie disciple, otherwise I'm out of the will. So I jumped on that. So anyway, all kidding aside, so I used God as an errand boy. Get me this. If you get me out of this scrape, I'll never do this again. If you get me that contract, I'll do this. If you get me this, the girl, the car, the house, whatever. And I really didn't understand my relationship. And so on the first page of chapter 4, what happens here is it asks those simple questions for me to go back and understand if I really am an alcoholic. So it says in the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. So it says, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. So if I'm, what the book is suggesting to me is saying to me that if I'm not willing to accept this spiritual experience, my recovery is going to be harder. It's not telling me I can't. And it's not saying, you know, go home, leave, don't put the book down. It's really saying to me, it's probably going to be harder. In my personal experiences, it was. It was very difficult for me. So next paragraph down, it states to me, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. So it's giving me two options, and I have to, again, look back at my experience of what my life was like, and what we'll get to on my life is on page 52 with the bedevilments. That's where I was living, but we're not there yet. So it's saying to me, I'm going to be doomed to an alcoholic death, or I get to live on this spiritual basis. And I can tell you, when I first read it, I was saying, well, let me see, alcoholic death, maybe it's not that bad. And it goes back to the doctor's opinion where it says the alcoholic's life seems like the only normal one. That was the pain I was in. I knew the pain. I had experienced it for so long. As painful as it was, I would rather stay there than change and move into something I didn't know about, or I was afraid to move into. So I struggled with that. Next paragraph down, it says, but after a while, we had to face the fact that we must find the spiritual basis of life or else. Perhaps it is going to be that way with you. But cheer up. Something like half of us thought we were atheists or agnostics. Our experience shows that you need not be disconcerted. If a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. So, I have this problem, and my problem is on the next paragraph. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be squiggly lines, right? Very important. Power greater than ourselves, obviously, but where and how were we to find this power? So I asked that question, and the book gives me the answer immediately. Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power, capital P, greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. That means we have written a book which we believe to be as spiritual as well as moral. So again, this book is giving me a promise. It's talking to me about if I can buy into this, if I can just hang in here, and if I can try to absorb this and stay with the fellowship, stay with my sponsor, stay with my network of men, stay with the people that I see are happy, joyous, and free, that I've got a chance. However, next paragraph down, it says, to others, the word God brought up a particular idea of him with which someone had tried to impress them during their childhood. Perhaps we rejected that particular conception because it seemed inadequate. With that rejection, we imagined we had abandoned the God idea entirely. We were bothered with the thought that faith and dependence upon a power beyond ourselves was somewhat weak, even cowardly. So, if you remember, I had said to you earlier, where did I get my knowledge of God? And I had gotten that as a child. These are my prejudices. And really what had happened was, nothing terrible had happened to me, but I was trying to absorb what my parents' concept of their God was and what they understood when they read the Bible and when they went through the sacraments. And the priest was giving me their conception of God as they had interpreted it, and the nuns, and as I went through catechism class. And all. So all of these people, for me at a very young age, were giving me their concepts. I had none because I was just following. I was following and doing what my parents said. I don't mean they did anything wrong. I just mean this is where I got it from. And I never moved past that. I never sought more formal education. I never sought any further understanding. So for me, I had to get past that hurdle. I had to get past that obstacle that I put there. No one else did it. But when I did, it became much easier. So further down the page, it says, much to our relief, it's a new paragraph, we discovered we did not need to consider another's concept of God. Remember what Evie said to Bill at the table. Choose your own concept of God. Make your own. Let it be whatever you want it to be. Carl said to me, what is yours? What do you want it to be? Shape it into anything that you want. Can be a kind and loving God. It's just got to be powerful. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect the contact with him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, those are capitals, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed by a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. We found that God does not make too hard terms for those who seek him. And I can state that unequivocally, that this is how it's worked in my life. And when I have, to the best of my ability, I know we're not there. Step three, turning my life over, my thoughts, my actions, over to God, which I don't understand sometimes, my life has gotten much simpler. So we're getting up onto next page. So top of the page, when therefore we speak to you of God, we mean of your own conception of God. This applies to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. So I've worked with a lot of men that have asked me for help and have asked me to take them through their steps, and I've had various experiences, and sometimes I have found that working with a man that has no experience with God has been easier when they're ready, because they seem to be more open. This is my experience. I had some experience in my life previously, and I had a bunch of prejudices. So I had to get past that. I had to move past that, and I have to say this to you. God giving me the opportunity to work with other men, to go on a on a 12-step call to tag along, and to witness that is a very moving experience for me. It really, for me, is an example of how God is in my life. And the examples that he gives me to follow if I choose. So, further on in this paragraph, it says, it has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. So there's the asterisk. Remember we talked about the spiritual experience. So this is the second time in the book that they're pushing us back to, if you've got the fourth edition, 567, third edition is 569, we don't have to read it, because I think most of you, we've been through this, and I may be boring you with this, but this, for me, this is the third time since I'm here we're reading it. I read it once in the doctor's opinion, we read it in the previous chapter, and now we're reading it again. In this book, obviously this is important. It's here twice. So, basically, I do, or if you haven't read it, I ask you to go home. Don't let me read the book for you. You read it yourself. And you come through this paragraph, because this chapter, the appendix, spiritual experience, appendix 2. And that for me, gave me the get-out-of-jail-free card, because I did not have the white light experience. And in there it talks about the educational variety. And that's what I needed to have. I needed to come through this slowly and reestablish my relationship with my higher power, because my prejudices were just too great. As willing as I was, my prejudices were too great. So I had to have that experience. I had to have things happen in my life, things that I faced, arrests and financial difficulties and failed marriage and family situations, businesses, that were being put back together. And I got a chance to participate in those and to see some things that made absolutely no sense to me whatsoever, but yet they were okay. They were turning into relationships, because I was beginning to start to lose my attachments. And there's a speaker called Peter Remy from Staten Island. He goes into great length and detail. If you get a chance, XA speakers, you can go up in there and catch some of Peter's talks, and he talks about attachments. What am I attached to? You know, what if my cell phone, the money, a car, or whatever it may be. Those attachments in man's world. Am I living in a spiritual world? And push me there. Constantly push me there. And that's what I needed to see. So, page 48. Few lines, let's see, about 8 lines down. Faced with alcoholic destruction, we soon became as open-minded on spiritual matters as we had tried to be on other questions. In this respect, alcohol was a great persuader. It finally beat us into a state of reasonableness. That's great. Very important. Sometimes this was a tedious process. We hope no one else with a prejudice will be prejudiced for as long as some of us were. So I want to jump ahead to page 52, because that talks about where I was at when I came in and feeling this way, and then being asked to accept the spiritual life was still difficult for me. But these are the bedevilments, and I don't know if you've heard people talk about it, if you've experienced it, but This is really the way that I felt after my last run. So the paragraph in the middle of the page, it says, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear, racked with fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution to these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight Of course it was. So my first sponsor is Sergio, and I was not ready, and I had such a hard time with step two. And he just finally said to me what this next paragraph says. What this paragraph says is, when we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. So those were not his exact words, but here's what he said to me. He said to me, if you think I'm full of crap, and you're not buying what I'm telling you, and you can't see how God's working in my life, go talk to the people that you're friendly with, that you're close with in the room. So I originally got sober in the 5:30 Florham Park meeting, and that was the afternoon. The morning was a 7:30 Unitarian, and I spent most of my first year in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, not hiding out, but God had seen fit to take most of everything out of my life. I had a tremendous amount of time, and I was so scared because I didn't think I could do this. My track record showed that I couldn't. So I spent so much time in the fellowship and working on my steps, trying to live them. So I would go to the people that were in those meetings that I could connect to, that I seemed to be attached to, that they had what I wanted. They were happy, joyous, and free. So I would sit with them. We would talk. We'd have coffee. We'd go for a ride, go to a meeting. And one thing that they all had in common was this spiritual experience. They had this relationship with a higher power. Not all of them were God. Not all of their higher powers were. But the common thing was they had this feeling that I'm going to be okay. Everything is going to be all right. And they had this relationship. And they began to share with me. And I could see it, because I could see in their lives. I could see they had death in their lives, and they coped with it. I saw there were babies being born in their lives and how they enjoyed that. I saw how they lost a house, who got a house, who got a job, who lost a job. But yet they were not drinking or taking dry goods, and they were getting through life, and they were understanding it, and they were balanced and grounded. So I spent a lot of time with them, and that's what that paragraph, it was very, very important to me, was, you know, see others, look at other people. And if they're the ones that you want, and I urge you, if you're struggling, if you're having a hard time, and you see other people that seem to be getting it, talk to them. Use their information, use their knowledge and their experiences. Because on the next page, in the middle, it says to me, when we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could not postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? So, for me, I was blessed enough the last time, back in 2007, the last time I came back, crawling back into these rooms, that I chose to go in that direction and to seek a better relationship with God. And my higher power put other people in my life when I had to move my location for a workplace. Carl B. came into my life, and Carl was just so important to me, that he has helped me so much with my relationship with God. So let's go over to page 55. And the book is going to now go through and give me some ideas, and it's gonna work towards cracking me open into opening myself up and feeling comfortable with step three, because I'm going to get into some action after that, and there are some things that I need to do, and I need to be right. My mind has to be right and focused. So in the middle of page 55, it says, actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. So maybe it is for you, maybe it's not. You know, maybe it is obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. But in some form or other, it is there. For faith is a power greater than ourselves, and the miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. So what does that mean to me? So my experience with that paragraph is simply this. I've had men that have come in that have absolutely rejected God, become angry and not violent, but their language and their tone is violent. And I ask them, just let's talk honestly for a second, and I really want you to be honest with me and talk to me about this. So at your darkest moment, at the worst of your addiction, your untreated alcoholism and drug abuse, and you were wherever you were, did you talk to yourself? Yes, I did. Okay. Well, what were you saying? I was asking for help, or I was asking for this, or I was asking for that. Well, who were you talking to then? Who was that person that you were talking to? Was there something else that you were asking for help? Because you were in a terrible situation. You were screwed. You were doomed. You were either going to jail, you were either passed out, you were either whatever your situation was. Who have you been talking to? And for me, I in my experience, I've gotten to sit there and to look at this expression on these men's face as they thought about it honestly and realized that they were really talking to something else. They were talking inside, inwardly. It wasn't coming out. Sometimes it was. But they were asking for help. They didn't understand or know what they were doing. This has been my experience. And after that, there was a little bit of a different, you know, it's a little crack in the armor, you know, where we could talk about a higher power or God or whatever it was, where they didn't become so, you know, it talks in a book, my mind snapped shut, you know, this contempt prior to investigation, and they were willing to start going through that. And that's what this entire chapter is about, is about asking me about, am I willing? Do I have this willingness? So, let's go to 56, and at this point they're talking about a gentleman by the name of Fitzmaio, and it started on the previous page, but Fitz's story is our Southern friend on the fourth edition. It's page 208. Again, I urge you to Google him up, silkworth.net. You can go out on the internet and Google up Fitzmaio, and that'll give you the backstory as to where this is. And that middle of the page, it comes into the end or the positive part, the solution for Fitz's story. And it says, one night when confined in a hospital, he was approached by an alcoholic who had known a spiritual experience. Our friend's gorge rose as he bitterly cried out, if there is a God, he certainly hasn't done anything for me. But later, alone in his room, he asked himself this question, is it possible that all the religious people I have known are wrong? While pondering the answer, he felt as though he had lived in hell. Then, like a thunderbolt, a great thought came. It crowded out all else. Who are you to say there is no God? So that last sentence in squiggly lines is pretty important, because who am I to say there is no God? What makes me so all-important and all, so knowledgeable for me? You'll figure it out for yourselves whether or not you feel that way or not. But who made me king to decide there is no God and that's it? I have to seek. I have to go out and I have to go find out whether there is or there isn't. I got to look for that. And I have to use my quiet voice to do that. Because for me, my God in my life speaks very quietly. He does not yell, does not scream, and he gives me some subtle little things. It could be through a difficulty in my life that he'll allow happen at a very short interval. And I kind of related to when I was a kid. And my parents would talk to me, or they would be calling me, take out the garbage, cut the, whatever it is, and I'm ignoring them, and I'm watching whatever I'm watching, you know, Car 54, Where Are You, and all of those old black and white great shows, you know, I Love Lucy, and I'm just totally ignoring them. And finally what would happen is either my mom or my dad would come and stand in front of the television and block it. And it was like, you know, okay, what? And then they had my attention. They had my undivided attention because they were there, right there, and I could not get around. I can't see through them. And I believe that in my life, that those things that happen in my life, those little difficulties, those things, you know, when I cried out to God in that, and my untreated alcoholism, that please let me start over again. I'll be a good boy. You know, I was using him as an errand boy again, but he was listening to me. I wasn't ready for what was going to happen, but he allowed me to clean my slate, and I needed to crash and burn, and I needed to be leveled out, and I needed to lose just about everything in my life because I lived in man's world. If you remember page 52, you can't be living a spiritual life and feel like I did on page 52. And I was so locked into me and blocking out God, no sunlight from God at all. So to finish up this chapter, it says on page 57, "What is this but a miracle of healing? Yet it is elements, but its elements are simple. Circumstances made him willing to believe. He humbly offered himself to his Maker. Then he knew. Even so, has God restored us all to our right minds? To this man, the revelation was sudden. Some of us grow into it more slowly, but he has come to all who have honestly sought him. When we drew near to him, he's disclosed himself to us." So God does not make too hard a task for those that seek him. In my experience, that's exactly what happened. So this book now has taken me to a point where I'm now willing to step two, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, right? What's the insane part of my life? I think I can drink safely. That curtain drops. I'm not thinking about what the consequences are. It's now got me to chapter 5 on page 58, how it works. And we're getting ready now to come into step 3. So step 3, and as I told you, I'm thick-headed. I'm thick-headed Italian, and I struggled with step 3 too, because all step 3 is a decision, and that silly thing that my sponsor laid on me was 5 frogs sitting on a log. 3 of them decide to jump off. How many are left? 2. No. 5. Because all they did was make a decision. And that just simply means that they had taken no action yet. And we're getting to that point where we're gonna start taking action. And step 3 is going to get me to that point where I'm going to make that decision that I'm going to now embark into this spiritual life, which is going to lead me into my 4th step. And that's a whole nother conversation, but a good one. So how it works is this decision, it's about living it. It's a decision, but living that decision and trying to follow through with it. And I can tell you now that in the course of a day, I'll take my will back, and I don't know how many times, and I constantly have to say that 3rd step prayer and just reaffirm, you know, and asking God to just take this from me. You know, I'm constantly grabbing the steering wheel out of his hand, and he's slapping me away, and I'm driving, leave it alone. So now we read this. I don't know if you do. The meetings that I go, most of the time we read this, and it says, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path." So it doesn't say everyone succeeds. It just says rarely who followed our path. So what does that mean? It means that the concepts of recovery as they're outlined in the first 164 pages. "Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves." So I raised my hand because that was me. relapse after relapse, and I could not be honest. I just couldn't grab it. There were honesty issues, and I just didn't know what that was. That was another thing that I needed to learn about being honest and understanding what's going on around me. I'm delusional. I have this strange perception of reality. So it says there are such unfortunates, but they are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. And if you continue with this, you'll understand as you go through your program that this is the honesty part is important. And as I began to live my steps, and I was going through them, especially going through my ninth step, and that humbling experience, but an uplifting and rewarding experience, that a lot of times what happens is my excuse to drink was taken away. If I looked at it honestly, there really was no good reason for me to have alcohol or drugs in my life. Although it changed the way I felt, there was no good reason, as what I stated when I first came in. If you had a job like mine, you had a life like mine, you had a wife like mine, you drink too. But that no longer was the truth. Thanks, Rich. Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. That no longer was true for me. So the honesty part about this was something that I needed to grasp onto, and that's where we're headed. That's where I'm headed when we got here. So it talks about on page 59, it goes through the steps. I know you've read them. But it describes the program to me. It gives me, because it'll give me the promises in the steps. So it says, one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. So in the weeks prior, I think we've beaten that one to death. I think that I believe we've covered it. Maybe not the best way, but that was my experience and the way that I understood step one. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, I believe that by the time I had finished We Agnostics, I was at that point, and I was willing. So here I am, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. So if I keep reading, the promises are in here, and really what happens is by the time I get to step 12, it clearly states for me, having had a spiritual awakening, as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So the promise there for me is if I continue through this and I follow what's outlined in the next chapters and the next pages, that I have a good shot of having this spiritual awakening. And the book has already stated to me, I don't know how many times, that I need that spiritual experience for me to have any kind of long-term sobriety. Because I was good at stopping drinking, I just couldn't stay stopped. And that's not a joke, that's just the truth. I could stop, I just couldn't stay stopped. So it says here in the middle of the page, our description of the alcoholic, which is the doctor's opinion, the chapter to the agnostic, right? We agnostics, we just, chapter 4, our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic, and if you're not sure what that is, go back to page 44, that first paragraph. You can ask yourself, and you can answer those questions for yourself. Am I an alcoholic? Do I drink alcoholically? Do I have an allergy? And could not manage our own lives. So there's step one. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. So that means a couple of things to me right there. So probably no human power. It's talking to me about we agnostics and this relationship with the higher power. But most importantly, it's reminding me, if I continue through, I'm going to have someone come to me and say, can you help me? And I'm going to be blessed with the opportunity to try to take that man through these steps, through this book, so he can experience this spirituality. I can't keep him sober. It's telling me no human power, not me, not you, not my mother, my father, unfortunately not you either, but can help. I can keep you sober. I'm sorry. You can help, but can't relieve me of my alcoholism. The answer is on C, that God could and would if he were sought. It's telling me all I need to do is seek him out. So, next paragraph. Being convinced of what? Well, let's figure out what that is. We were at step 3, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? Well, okay, so the part about convinced about what, so it's saying to me, if by the time I get to this point in the book, if I'm not convinced that I'm an alcoholic and my life is unmanageable, and if I'm not convinced that the spiritual power can restore me to sanity, I might want to drop back a little bit. It's not saying go away, you don't get it, you failed the test. What was taught to me, because I struggled here, I struggled in this step. So they said, okay, let's go back a couple of pages. Let's go back a chapter. We must have missed something. Maybe we didn't get it. And we went back, and we did it. Not as punishment, but what it was, because I wanted what was in here. I want this. I want these promises in my life. So it says, it's a question, just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? There's a question mark there. Well, okay, here's the answer. It's a good workbook. It tells me the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. I have my videotape to prove self-will. I have that. I have all of my experience prior to coming up into here, prior to the rooms of alcoholic, to go back and take a look at. If I have any doubt as to what I act like and how I think, when my self-will run riot. On that basis, we are always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. I don't know if you've ever experienced that. I didn't know it. I did not see it. As a child, my dad, my mom loved me very much. They gave me what I believed was the self-confidence. My dad told me, don't you ever let anybody tell you no. There's nothing you can't do in this world if you don't put yourself through it. It was reinforced in sports, playing football. Your job is take that man out in front of you. I don't want to know anything. You take him out and that's the end result. Don't let him stand in your way. As I got older in business, in life, I didn't know what I was really doing. It was starting to come down to motives. It was starting to get to a point where I was beginning to take a look, and I was being challenged to look at my motives. What are you really doing, Tom? What are you really trying to accomplish? You say this, but is this really what deep down inside you're really looking to accomplish? So it says that the is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. And it was like, wow, I never looked at it that way, but you're right. His arrangements, his arrangements would stay put. If only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. I thought I was. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. I told you I'm delusional. I believed all of those things. I wasn't a villain. But my motives and my thinking had become distorted by the time I had gotten into these rooms. Alcohol, drugs, my life, the people that I had put myself in, I'm a direct reflection of the people I choose to surround myself with. So I really was only hanging out with people that were as bad as me or worse than I was. And the ones that were worse than me, I sought out because it made me feel healthier. I didn't realize that. I didn't know what I was doing. So it goes on to say, on the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. I told you already I had honesty issues when I came in here. So I was dishonest, a liar, a cheat, and a thief. Didn't mean I robbed banks. It just meant that you couldn't count on most of what I was saying, especially in the last 2 years of my untreated alcoholism. I cheated my family out of time. I cheated my daughter out of time with me. And the thief was, you know, it wasn't the fact that I was stealing something material, but I was trying to get as much as I could get out of someone else in my life because I was sick. And I don't say that like I'm right or I justify it, because I don't. But I was sick. I was insane. And that's how I lived my life. I referred you back to 52. There's no considerate, patient, generous on page 52, so that's where I was. It says here he decides to exert himself more. He becomes on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that other people are more to blame. Of course, they are. I can't take a look at myself this way, honestly. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Question. Is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? I talked to you about my motives. I talked to you about how I lived my life, the way that I was looking at things. Is he not a victim? And here comes in this whole part about the material world, because in my early days in the rooms, you know, I talked about the fellowship was not enough. So, and then I talked about how when things would quiet down, it'd be quiet. I'd get off the couch, I was back in the bedroom. My business partners had quieted down. I thought things were okay. But what was really happening was my material life was settling down. You know, it was getting quiet again. So these next few lines describe me. It says, is he not a victim? Right? So a victim is someone that's innocent, but yet something is inflicted upon them. Is he not a victim of the delusion, right? We know I'm delusional, right? The false sense of reality. That he can rest. Rest to me is like forceful, exerting. Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? I raise my hand. That's how I judged my life, my sobriety. I wasn't dealing with spirituality. So my bank account's starting to grow again. Everything's quiet. I'm off the couch. Things seem to be going well. I have a little bit of success. I think I can drink. I think I'm in control. I think I'm all right. Nobody's paying attention. It is not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants. And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not, even in his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? I giggle not because I think it's really funny. It's so distorted, my thinking, so twisted, that I'm the one who's causing the problems. It referenced a few sentences about the retaliation. And that'll come in our fourth step. But I'm that part in that last column where, in a fourth step, where I'm not seeing I caused it. And really what happened is the person, my ex-wife, all she did was reacted back to my bad behavior. And now I'm blaming her. That was a big deal for me to see that, to have my eyes open. And it just gives a couple of examples of, you know, a retired businessman who lulls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation. You know, so we go to page 62, and there's motive here again. I have written on the page. So it says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we had made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. I played the victim when I came in. I played the victim. My sponsor told me you suffer from terminal uniqueness. You need to pay attention. So it goes on to say, our troubles we think are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually does not think so. So we're now coming in, and we're moving into page 63, where I now need to understand my relationship with God. So it says in the middle of page 63, we are now at step 3. Many of us said to our Maker as we understood him, squiggly lines. Now, both of my sponsors, when we were at this point in my steps, asked me to get on my knees and say this prayer with them. They got on their knees with me. The first time I did it, it was a little weird for me. You know, a tough kid from Newark, and getting on my knees with another man and saying this prayer for no other reason other than it's humbling. For me, it was humbling to get on my knees. Although I go to church, I do that and whatever. For a long time, I said my prayers on one knee when I came in this program. It was my defiance. It was my pride and my ego refusing to let me just become a humble and grateful man. But I got on my knees, both with Sergio and Carl, and we said the third step prayer, and it's powerful. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. That's a big statement, because here I am, take me. You mold me. Relieve me of the bondage of self. What does that mean? It said it on the earlier page, selfishness, self-centeredness. Relieve me of the bondage of self, because when I'm thinking about me, I'm not thinking about helping someone else. I'm not thinking about letting God into my life. I'm wrapped up with me. That I may better do thy will. What is thy will? I don't know yet. I didn't know yet. So I didn't know how to make my decisions. And so Sergio would say to me, so you want to go talk to that married woman over there? What would God do? And it would give me a chance to pause. It was an exercise that he taught me, and it gave me a chance to look at it honestly, right? We talked about this program of honesty. And if I'm really honest with myself, what is my motive? What am I doing? Do you have any business being there? Where are you really going? I'm like, well, I want to help her through her difficulties. She's having a hard time. She's new in the firm. No. You know, and I have no business being there, and I need to take a look at that. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. And I'll close out by saying this. It says, we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. So that sounds like a very, that sounds like a commitment, abandoning myself utterly to him. And it really, all I had said earlier was this decision. And knowing that I take my will back so many different times. But I need to continue to make that decision, especially considering I'm getting ready. On the bottom of the page, it says we launched out on a vigorous, on a course of vigorous action. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning. I'm going to start getting into my fourth step, and I need to start identifying the things that are blocking God, and I need to try to be as honest as I possibly can. My first fourth step was ugly, but we did it. And I don't want to say it was negative, because I'm not going to tell you it was negative. I'm not one of those guys. I know I'm jumping ahead, but I'm going to tell you right now. I'm not one of those guys to tell you that, oh, it was so terrible. It was bad. I almost drank over. It was one of the most spiritual, uplifting things in my life that I have ever done, to finally be honest. Because I had to do my fourth and fifth step at the same time. That's how hard I fought it. But we can get into that next week. Sergio needed to pull me through this thing fourth and fifth at the same time, and we could talk it out and be honest. So that's it for me. And I want to thank you. I love you all. I'm truly grateful.